Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
First off, here is the MP3 disc, 25 MP3s, the Book of Exodus disc 2. So this will go with the Book of Exodus disc 1 up there. For a grand total of, I think, 50, if not quite near 50 messages so far in the book of Exodus, and we're only to chapter 35. But anyway, if you want this disc, it'll be up on our website soon. We ask $5 for one of these discs if you want it sent. Those of you who are here in the room, just learn to use the copier in the front room, and it's yours. All right, that will be up in the front office. We are in chapter 35 of the book of Exodus. As I told you last week, and speaking of which, let me remind you that we won't be here next Wednesday. We're taking Wednesday off because everybody will be traveling and going to see family and having Thanksgiving. So there's no meeting here next Wednesday unless you just want to be alone in the parking lot by yourself, which you're welcome to do. But as I told you last week, from this point into the next several chapters, it's just very detailed information about the actual construction of the tabernacle. And one of the problems with doing a verse-by-verse study of any book is that you don't get to skip stuff. And I even thought about maybe just summarizing the next couple chapters just so we could get by them, except that in the midst of the details, every once in a while, there's these interesting little bits that jump out. So we're going to read it through verse-by-verse because, again, there's nothing more interesting in life than listening to Jim read. And so we're going to start at, I think verse 20 is where we get into the new material, but let's start at verse 10 so that we can just kind of build up speed as we go. You know that we last week reached the point where Moses was taking up an offering from the children of Israel for the building of the tabernacle. God is precise about what he wants and what he expects. And as we go through the next few chapters and I read it out, one of the things I want you to see as it starts becoming almost redundant, I want you to see the detail God went into. He didn't leave it up to Moses or anybody else. He didn't say, build me a tabernacle, nah, you figure it out. And listen to the amount of beauty and splendor, the amount of brass, the amount of silver, the amount of gold, the amount of stuff that they use to build this tabernacle. Now, when we mentioned it several months ago the first time and talked about the construction, I pointed out that from the outside, if you were an Israelite encamped on one of the four sides as they originally encamped around the tabernacle, or if you were an Israelite in the camp when the tabernacle was outside the camp, when you looked at it from the outside, it just looked like a large tent covered with animal skins. Nothing spectacular about it from the outside. From the inside, looking out, beautiful, full of color, gold and silver, splendor, the high priest dressed in beautiful garb, and the Levites day and night constantly doing the work inside the temple were the only people who ever got to see it. Which means that the vast majority of the people who are going to do the giving to build it, once it's built, never see it. Never get to see the beauty and the splendor of what's constructed. All they know is that once it's built, even the men who do the physical construction, who make the rings or who sew the draperies, even the people who have done the work, once it's constructed, don't ever get to see it again. Never get to see their work again because it now belongs to God. And God takes it completely to himself, so that whenever God comes to talk to Moses or send information to Israel through Moses or meets Joshua or anyone else at the door there, whenever he does that, God sees beauty and splendor. All the human beings get to see is the animal skins on the outside. Why? Because once again, you're not God. God's not you. You're not like God. And God can say, this is mine. Make my stuff differently than you make your stuff. Make my stuff better than your stuff. Make my viewing area better than your viewing area. I'm always fascinated when scientists discover, quote unquote, things like deep, deep, deep in the ocean. They'll find something that was in some dark crevasse in some cave in the ocean, and they'll see it, and they'll say, you know, no human has ever seen this before. It's a brand new animal, a brand new species we've never seen before near the bottom of some dark area of the ocean, and they'll shine light on it, and it will actually be quite attractive. Have you ever seen those jellyfish? They're those beautiful, unbelievable, practically fluorescent jellyfish. Do you realize how long those were on the planet that human beings never got to see them? But God knew they were there. God saw that stuff. He saw all that. They discovered a primate, Megan and I were looking at pictures of him today, that scientists thought had been extinct now for hundreds and hundreds of years. This little, tiny, little monkey-looking little primate guy with great big buggy eyes. All this time, human beings haven't seen him, haven't known where he was, didn't get... God knew. God fed this line of animals, kept them alive, made sure that they had health and food and everything else for all these years, and human beings had no idea they were even there. In fact, they had been officially stamped as gone off the planet by the scientists who we trust to know everything. You know, those scientists who will tell you how we all got here and how natural selection works. And then they'll tell you, and this animal is completely gone, till they show up again. And the whole time, God provided for that animal. You see, God can actually say to human beings, make things for me, and then walk away, it's not yours anymore, it's mine. And I can do whatever I want with it. And in fact, I can tell you to never look at it again, never come near it again. It's mine. So as we read through these details, and there are plenty of details, don't lose track of the fact that all of this beauty and all of this gold and all of this brass and all of this silver and all of this construction, all this fine weaving and all these beautiful curtains and all this stuff is being made for God's glory and not for any man's glory. And God can do that if he wants. So starting at verse 10 of chapter 35, let every skillful man among you come and make all that the Lord has commanded. That's interesting. It starts right off with, God commanded you to make some things. So now every man that is skillful, come use your skill for the glory of God. Long as we're here, I'll make a comment I was going to make in 10 minutes anyway, but before we get into the meat of it. Several people are going to be named here, two in particular, who God is going to name by name and say that he gave them wisdom and skill and ability to do particular craft. Now, they probably thought while they were in Egypt and had acquired skills and craftsmanship, they probably assumed that they had those skills and ability for their own sake, for their own livelihood, for their own ability to do work and impress the Pharaoh or their bosses or the workmen. God makes it clear that the reason they have that skill in the first place was so that they'd be here at this juncture in time to do his work to bring him glory. I contend all the time that whatever ability you have, whatever skill you have, whatever knowledge you've gained in this life, it is ultimately not for your benefit. You may gain some benefit from it, sure, but ultimately it's not for you. It's for God's glory. I can only put it in the context of musicians and music, because Tom and I play music here. Tom and I had professional music careers. Tom and I know what it is to play concerts and play beer bars and have people throw things at you. We know what it's like to play to rough audiences, and we know what it's like to play to adoring crowds. And we know what it is to go out there and play music. And for much of our lives, we thought that we had that ability for our glory. And there... Pardon me?
It felt that way.
It felt that way, didn't it? Oh, there's nothing more egocentrically satisfying than to be in a room of 25,000 people and be the best lit, loudest person in the room. When you're that guy, that feels really, really good. Especially when you're surrounded by people whose paycheck is dependent on you getting up there and doing that every night. So they'll give you anything you want and prop you up and feed your ego because they need you up on that stage every night. That's a fun feeling in your flesh. I don't think Tom or I would have believed that at this point in our life and at this age that the primary place that we focused our music was now in church for God's glory. But that's what the gift was for. All those years of training, all those lessons, even all the performing was ultimately for God's glory. You know what I found out through all that performing? Because I got to do lots of performing, and boy, if anybody ever got their ego fed, oh, hey, I am King Ego. And what I found out in the midst of all that was how truly debilitating ego is. And God didn't let me in a pulpit until he made sure I got all that ego stuff out of my head. Once he drove that ego out of me, and once he made me understand that everything that happens in the church environment, and in fact, everything that happens in my life, is for his glory, then he started using me. But first he had to teach me those things. Well, I'm sure that these guys, I'm sure that the craftsmen of Israel, it says every skillful man among you, have him come and make all that the Lord has commanded. I'm sure those people approached it with the attitude of, well, God's fortunate he's got somebody like me around who has this skill. Because here God has commanded somebody to make a brass laver of cleansing. Now, that's not an easy thing to do. You got to have some skill. You got to know how to work some brass. You got to know how to heat it, how to hammer it out, how to make it circular, and how to create the bowl, and how to keep the seams together. You got to have some skill to do that. It was just fortunate that God would have them in the midst, having picked up all those skills in Egypt. Because now God's demanding something that requires skill to make. And so in a few verses, God's going to take credit for it and say, I planted those skills in them. There's no chance here. There's a sovereign God creating what he has chosen to create for his glory. All right, I've got so much to read, and here I am. I'm getting way ahead of myself. Let every skillful man among you come and make all that the Lord has commanded, the tabernacle and its tent and its covering, its hooks and its boards, its bars, its pillars and its sockets, the ark and its poles, the mercy seat and the curtain of the screen, the table and its poles and all its utensils, and the bread of presence, the lampstand also for the light and its utensils, and its lamps, and the oil for the light, and the altar of incense, and its poles, and the anointing oil, and the fragrant incense, and the screen for the doorway at the entrance of the tabernacle, the altar of burnt offering with its bronze grating, its poles, all its utensils, the basin and its stand, the hangings of the court, its pillars and its sockets, and the screen for the gate of the court, the pegs of the tabernacle and the pegs of the court and their cords, the woven garment for ministering in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments of his sons to minister as priests. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel departed from Moses' presence, and everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting and for all its service and for the holy garments. Then all whose hearts moved them, both men and women, came and brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and bracelets, all articles of gold. So did every man who presented an offering of gold to the Lord. And every man who had in his possession blue and purple and scarlet material and fine linen and goat's hair and ram skins dyed red and porpoise skins brought them. And everyone who could make a contribution of silver and bronze brought the Lord's contribution. And every man who had in his possession acacia wood for any work of the service brought it. And all the skilled women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet material and in fine linen. And all the women whose hearts stirred with a skill spun the goat's hair. And the rulers brought the onyx stones and the stones for the setting of the ephod and for the breastpiece and the spice and the oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. The Israelites, all the men and women whose hearts moved them to bring material for the work which the Lord had commanded through Moses to be done, brought a freewill offering to the Lord. Then Moses said to the sons of Israel, "See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and God has filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all craftsmanship, to make designs for working in gold and in silver and in bronze, and in the cutting of stones for the settings, and in the carving of wood, so as to perform in every inventive work." So this is a really creative guy, really inventive craftsman, who knows how to make beautiful, skillful work. But God is sure to say first, call him by name, and then say, and I put in him the Spirit to be able to do that. God takes all the credit. So all the offering, all the gold, all the silver, all the bronze, all the material, all the red and the purple and the blue and the fine linen and their bracelets and their earrings and their brooches, everything that they're bringing, where did they get it?
From the Egyptians.
Because God said, take it and then I'm going to deliver you. So God provided for them first everything necessary for the offering God was going to take. Now, did God give them all that so that they would be enriched, so that they could have everything they wanted and go buy big houses and palaces and drive a Cadillac? No, God gave them all that so that when he required an offering, there would be plenty for the offering. So God provided the construction plans. Then he chooses the people who are going to serve. It's going to be Aaron and it's going to be his sons. Then he's going to choose the Levites. It's going to be the tribe of Levi only. And I need an offering, and he provides all the stuff for the offering. And then he says, and I need skillful men, and I'll provide skillful men. And I'll provide those skillful men with the wisdom and the ability and the Spirit to be able to do the things that I'm going to require to be done in the place that I'm going to require to have built with all the material that I provided for you. It's just all God, 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 glorifying himself through the people of Israel. Now, what that shows us, and this is a real important concept. This is one of the ways that God works. One of the argumentative discussions that I have very frequently with folks is that they'll say, based on what you're saying, Jim, if God elects, if God chooses, if God determines who he's going to save, then why evangelize? You've probably heard that, right? Anybody who's been around Reformed theology at all, it's a very common argument. They'll say, well, if God's going to save, who God's going to save? Why bother to evangelize? From a theological, methodological standpoint, what we know about God throughout the Bible is that there are a lot of things God could do by himself that he doesn't. Instead, he uses means. And in theological circles, that term is used a lot. Means. God uses means. In other words, God has an end in mind, but he doesn't just simply accomplish the end right at the beginning. He has an end determined, and then he uses processes in time, particular people, particular circumstances, to accomplish his end goal. Don't you think the God who made the whole wide world and the universe and all the planets and the stars, who knows every star by name, don't you think if he wanted a tabernacle made out of goat's hair, he could have whipped one up? Don't you think a few good words, let there be light, let there be tabernacle, let there be laver of cleansing? Don't you think he could have just made them?
Yes.
Yeah, of course he could. Why didn't he? Because this is consistent with how God works all the way through the Bible. He uses means, and in the process of using means, he creates relationship between himself and his people. We evangelize because the means God uses to produce faith and salvation is the preaching of his gospel. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. That's the method that God uses. And if faith comes by hearing, that means somebody has to speak it. If faith comes by hearing the gospel, that presupposes that somebody's going to preach the gospel. And so God uses the means of preaching in order to produce faith in the people he is saving. Could God just snap his fingers and save the people he wants to save? Sure he could. But he doesn't, because he doesn't work that way. Instead, he works in a way that brings all glory to his Son through the implantation of the Holy Spirit that produces faith in the finished work of his Son, and in those means creates a relationship between him and his people. He doesn't require an offering, nor does he require a tabernacle from any other people group on the planet at this moment. He chooses Israel and then requires things from Israel, because in that process, he's creating his relationship with Israel. See, God doesn't require the same things from the world that he requires from his people. He requires different things from the church, the elect, the chosen from before the foundation of the world. He requires a difference between them and the rest of the world. And he reacts to his chosen people differently than he reacts to the world. There's nowhere in the Bible where it says that God corrects the behavior of the world. It does say that he will punish the behavior of the world. He's going to judge the behavior of the world. It's very clear in Revelation 20 when the books are open and every man is tried by what's written in the books and they're judged according to their works. But are you concerned about being tried for your works? No, because you're a different group. The relationship is different. And the relationship is different because it's been developed over time in the way that God has required things from you that he didn't require from the world. The book of Hebrews says, "Whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son he receives." And then he says, and if you haven't received that kind of scourging, you're not a son. So God corrects his children for the purpose of, the end of that passage says, that the punishment, the scourging, isn't fun while you're going through it, but it produces the peaceable fruit of righteousness. So the relationship that God has with his people has a purpose, has an end game in mind, and the end result is the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Does God expect the peaceable righteousness out of the heathens who hate him? No, absolutely not. So there's a difference between God's people and the world, and the relationship between God and his people is developed by the way that he uses them as means toward his ends. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. And so to do those things through his creatures, through people he created.
Exactly right. You just said in 10 seconds what it took me 10 minutes to say. He requires something completely different and expects something completely different out of his people because he has a different relationship with his people than he has with the people who are his enemies. And so he wants a tabernacle built, but he's going to require that his people do it. Now, what is Israel learning through this process?
God is holy.
God is holy. What else?
He's the only one.
It's going to be what?
He's different.
Yeah, he's different. Absolutely. What else are they learning?
He's precise.
He's very precise. He's very exacting. Yeah.
He gives us what we need to do the work that he wants us to do.
Absolutely. What else are they learning?
Sovereign.
He's sovereign. What else are they learning? There's a lot here. There's plenty here.
Keep to fear him.
They're learning to fear him. Do it his way. Do it. Yeah, they learned that at Mount Sinai, didn't they? Yeah. What else are they learning?
They learned to reverence his word.
Reverence his word. If God says it, do what God says. Sure. They're also learning God can require things from you. God can give you a law and say, this is my law, do it or die. They're learning that God can say, oh, you know that stuff you've got? I'll take that now. This is a way to worship him. Absolutely. It's a form of recognizing who he is and reacting to who he is. It's a form of worship. Absolutely. All of that is wrapped up in God dealing with his people in a way that he does not deal with the world. And he is revealing facets of himself, his characteristics, his personality, his attributes, and he's revealing them to his people in a way that he simply does not reveal himself to the world. Jesus walked around saying things like, count the cost. because there actually is a cost involved with being a child of God. And that cost includes not being able to be like the world. No matter how much fun it looks like the world's having, part of the cost is you don't get to be like them. But then again, what is forever compared to the 40, 50, 60 years you don't get to be like the world? Because the day is coming when the world is going to really think you're the one having all the fun. All right, let's keep plowing forward here. We got as far as
verse 34.
He's just gotten done telling us about this guy, this Bezalel. He also put in his heart to teach. Isn't that interesting? So not only does he have this skill, but he's going to pass this skill on. Now that's really helpful if you have to have apprentices to get all the work done. But God takes credit for that and says, and God has put it in his heart to teach others what he knows. We like to think, being egocentric humans, we like to think that if we pass on some knowledge we have, that that is just part of the magnanimousness of us. God takes credit for it. He says, oh, and I've also put it in his heart to teach. Both he and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, who is of the tribe of Dan. And he filled them with skill to perform every work of an engraver and of a designer and of an embroiderer in blue and in purple and in scarlet material and in fine linen and of a weaver as performers of every work and makers of designs. Now, Bezalel and Aholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord has put skill and understanding to know how to perform all the work in the construction of the sanctuary shall perform in accordance with all that the Lord has commanded. That's just a fascinating verse on its own. It says, every skillful person in whom the Lord has put skill, every person who has the understanding to know how to perform the work, will perform the work in accordance with everything the Lord has commanded about the work. So the Lord commanded it. The Lord drew up the plans. The Lord put the skill in the people to do the plans and then put the willingness in the people to do the plans that the Lord had constructed. It's all God, 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 God. Then Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him, to come to the work to perform it. And they received from Moses all the contributions which the sons of Israel had brought to perform the work in the construction of the sanctuary. And they still continued bringing to him freewill offerings every morning. Boy, that's an easy offering, isn't it? You just walk outside your tent and the people are coming with the stuff. And why are the people coming with the stuff? We talked about it last week. Because God's in charge of this and has put in their hearts and put in their minds the willfulness to do it. Verse 4, and all the skillful men who were performing all the work of the sanctuary came, each from the work which he was performing, and they said to Moses, the people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work, which the Lord commanded us to perform. So Moses issued a command, and a proclamation was circulated throughout the camp, saying, let neither man nor woman any longer perform work for the contributions of the sanctuary. Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more. Now, that's interesting too, because within the history of sects of the church who often end up to be cults, they say, here's what God requires from you. He wants you to give me everything you own. Sell your house, sell your car, and bring all the money to me. Bring me everything, leaving the participants with nothing. You don't see that here. You see God getting enough to do the work he required and then saying to the people, who obviously have more because they're still bringing more, no, no, you keep what's left. The rest of it's for you. Which means when he provided for them in Egypt, he provided everything necessary for his construction and his tabernacle and enough for them to have plenty for themselves. Be aware whenever you hear some man say, bring me everything. You need to have nothing. I need a Learjet. You need to end up with nothing. Or the people who say, if you have nothing, if you're down to nothing, plant a seed faith gift of $10,000 and go to the bank and borrow it or put it on your credit card, believing that God is going to provide the means to pay it back. You don't find that kind of silliness anywhere in the Bible. What you find is God providing for his people, and then out of what God has provided, God expects generous giving in return. Nowhere in the Bible do you find the idea that you should go broke in faith to put God to the test. There's a word for that. It's called presumption. You don't presume on God. There is among the name it, claim it faith preachers out there, I'm not going to name names, but there is a very prominent church here in Nashville that teaches that you should run up massive debt so that you have a faith opportunity that God will have to provide for you or you'll go under. By the way, I'm talking about a guy that's on TV several times a week here in town, has a great big church, demands, you know, minimum 10% tithes out of everybody, and has tied your prosperity to your faith. And so if you're not prospering, you're not faithful. And so the members of the church will go into massive debt to buy things they can't afford to show the other members of the congregation how well-to-do they are. And then they're going broke, especially in the economy right now. They're all going belly up and going bankrupt. And asking the question, well, then where is God in all this? And you know what answer they're getting from their preacher?
You didn't have enough faith.
It's your fault. My point is, the Bible just isn't that complicated when it comes to giving and your relationship to God where giving is concerned. It's just not that complicated. The Old Testament's cut and dry. Bring these tithes, bring these offerings, then you can bring your free will offerings and do it. It's a requirement. It's a tax on Israel, the tithe is, in order to pay for the Levites and the widows and the fatherless, and in order that you'll always have something to bring to the feast. God lays it out in detail, do it this way, then whatever's left over is yours. In the New Testament, in the New Covenant, you find the same thing. According as every man purposes in his heart, so let him give. You don't find, bring me absolutely everything, or you don't believe in me. God knows you have needs. He knows you have requirements, and he provides for you. You give out of what God has provided for you. But the assumption, whether old covenant or new, is that God has provided for you sufficiently that you do have something to give. There's nobody who can get away with saying, I just don't have enough. I can't give anything. And I think we could prove that from Jesus looking at the widow who gave her last two mites. And Jesus didn't say, by all means, go and get that woman and give her back her money. Instead, he eulogized the woman and said, see what she's done. All these others gave out of their great abundance, so they gave virtually nothing. If a millionaire gives $5, what is that? But he said, this woman gave all that she had. And even though it was very little, it was a huge gift in the eyes of God. So giving is not about how much you give, it's about how much you have versus how much you give. And so Israel was given plenty in order to give an offering so abundant it could build this magnificent tabernacle in the wilderness with all the furniture in it and then have left over. And Moses could say, okay, now whatever's left over, yours. Do you remember in the book of Acts, the story of Ananias and Sapphira? One of the few places in the New Covenant, in the New Testament, where God just kills a couple people. And you remember what he killed them for?
Lying.
Lying about what?
Giving.
About money and giving. There's only two places in the New Covenant, in the New Testament, where it says God killed people for doing something wrong. One is taking communion, and the other is lying about your giving. Well, that puts those two events on a pretty high plane compared to everything else. But the real interesting part of that story that you never hear emphasized, from the pulpit you always hear, now don't lie about your giving. Ananias and Sapphira brought everything they had, but they held some back. That means God doesn't want you to hold anything back. Bring it all, bring everything, and let, you know, that's the way it's usually preached. They never pay attention to the last thing Peter tells Ananias when he comes in.
When it was in your own hand, it was yours.
When it was in your hands, it was yours. Why'd you bother to lie about it? It was yours to start with. You didn't have to lie about it. You see, that was the thing. He wanted to put on that, oh, we gave everything. We're just like the rest of you. We gave everything. And they weren't required to give everything. Those who felt that they could give more, gave more. But they wanted to look like they were giving more, lied about giving more, and before that got any further into the church, God dropped them both dead. But Peter said, it was yours to start with. You didn't have to lie. But the lying and the looking like you're doing what you're not really doing, that's what got them killed. But what was in their hands was theirs. Whatever you've got that's in your hands that God has given you, that's yours. You don't have to put on airs for anybody. You don't have to lie for anybody. You don't have to put on a show for anybody. What's yours has been given to you by God. And then between you and God, you determine what you're going to give. But the assumption is always that you will give because God has provided. You got that? Okay. Where are we, Tom?
I went and spoke up.
Did we get as far as... Oh, we got as far as verse 6, didn't we? Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more. That's right. So we're on verse 7. For the material that they had was sufficient and more than enough for the work to perform it. And all the skillful men among those who were performing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen and blue and purple and scarlet material, with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman, Bezalel made them. Isn't that great? Now, listen to that description. It was curtains made with fine twisted linen, blue and purple and scarlet, with angels, cherubim, sewn into them. Wouldn't that be beautiful?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
There's got to be... I believe that through the history, I think they really knew what these angels, what these cherubim looked like.
It's an interesting thought. Somewhere somebody had the concept.
Really looked like.
Well, you know, Moses was told while he was up on the mountain that when they made the kapparath, the covering for the Ark of the Covenant, there were going to be two cherubim, one on each side with their wings touching each other. So, yes, there was some kind of realization of what this looked like. I agree with you.
Jim, I have a question.
Sure.
Okay. Build the tabernacle, the people brought the best of what they had. The workmen made it gorgeous.
Yep.
There are churches out there that spend millions of dollars making their edifices gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
But God didn't command them to do that. So, to me, I would rather have a simple building and have money to help people pay their rent than to have a crystal cathedral.
Right. What you're talking about now is the difference between what God commanded from Israel in the Old Testament, Old Covenant, and how the church acts in the New Covenant. Where did the church meet?
In houses.
In houses, in homes. Now, granted, some of them were nice. The Palatia Britannicum in Rome, where the Gentile church met, was a palace. And so the church met in buildings that were available buildings. I have never minded the idea of churches having a designated place to meet. I know that when I in the past have gone into very large, very ornate cathedrals, at least the motivation was God's glory. That's turned. We've turned a corner now. I'm not convinced that the large rock and roll auditoriums being built now are for God's glory. It's for entertainment value. And it's in order to be able to put on a bigger, fancier show. So at some point, you know, they turned a corner where the motivation went from the glory of God to the glory of men. But so did the theology. The theology used to be for the glory of God and the glory of God's word. I've told you before that in the architecture of the early Catholic Church, the centerpiece, as we've all seen, if you go into a Catholic church, the centerpiece is the altar. Because that's where the Mass takes place. That's where the bloodless sacrifice happens. The Hocus Corpus Meus, the transubstantiation, all happens there, which is why in the Reformation, the first churches that were used as Reformation churches and that were built in Germany and Switzerland, Geneva, they purposefully put the pulpit at the center of the church. And there was always an open Bible on the pulpit because the highest raised up thing in the church was the Word of God. instead of the altar. So furniture, setting, all of that can teach, can speak, can focus you. But at that point, the glory of God was the central issue. And I agree with that. I agree with the centrality of the glory of God, so that when you walk in the building, even the architecture drives you to that realization, the glory of God. I don't get that feeling of the glory of God when I walk into the showbiz church, because it feels like Opryland. It feels like show business. It does not feel like reverence toward God. The tabernacle here was clearly all about God's glory and God's reverence. They were going to revere God in what they were doing. So I said all that to say, I think in the end, it really has to do with the heart and the purpose for which the building is being constructed, the people who are building it, and what the motivation is. I've been in some awe-inspiring, you know, I was in England, I went into some of those old, gorgeous churches there, and it's awe-inspiring. There is a sense of wonder and beauty to it. And when you read the history of the sacrifice of the people who built these for the glory of God, it's hard to criticize that. But I've yet to walk into a showbiz church that had that same sense. So I think in the end it comes down to what's your purpose, what's your point. There are people who have criticized us because we moved out of my house into this building. We couldn't fit people in my house anymore. So we got this building so that we could become a public church, have more people in. And there are people who have criticized that because we spent money on this instead of multiple other charitable things I suppose we could have done with the money. If you're going to be hard-lined about it, then you've got to be really clear about where's the line, what's too much. Well, who's capable of saying that? Who's capable of saying GCA is justifiable? And then Main Street, that's a big church. Okay, that's justifiable. But the Catholic church right up the road from there is too ornate, not justifiable. How do you do that? I don't think you can. I think you need to leave that up to the people who built it, the sacrifice that went into it, their purpose for doing it. This building is here as a public building for GCA because a lot of people sacrificed so that we could have this. And I think that was all for the honor and the glory of God, and God has been more than gracious in the way he's provided for it. So he gets the glory from it. But we also are careful to protect it and not let it become about me or Tom or Steve or any other human. It's about God, which is why I love telling the God is faithful stories like I did on Sunday, because this building speaks to God's faithfulness. Does that kind of answer your question? I'm not comfortable drawing a real clear line and saying, okay, all those are bad, but this one's okay and this one's good, you know? Yeah. In the end, it comes down to what's the motivation, what was the purpose, what was the heart of the people who did it in the first place? Right. Yeah? Anything else? Okay. We are at verse 10. No, we'll start at verse 8. All the skillful men among those who were performing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains, of fine twisted linen and blue and purple and scarlet material, with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman. Bezalel made them. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits, and the width of each curtain was 4 cubits, and all of the curtains had the same measurements. And he adjoined 5 curtains to one another, and the other 5 curtains he joined to one another. And he made loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain in the first set. And he did likewise on the edge of the curtain that was on the outermost of the second set. And he made 50 loops in the one curtain, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was in the second set. And the loops were opposite each other. And he made 50 clasps of gold and joined the curtains to one another with the clasps. So the tabernacle was a unit. And he made the curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. He made 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits, and 4 cubits the width of each curtain, and 11 curtains had the same measurement. And he joined 5 curtains by themselves, and the other 6 curtains by themselves. Moreover, he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the first set, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the second set, and he made 50 clasps of bronze to join the tent together that it might be a unit. So what you've got is the inside wall, the beautiful curtains, and they're hung with gold clasps. And then you've got the outer goat's hair curtain, which is being called the tent. That's the outer side that the people would see from the outside, and that has bronze clasps holding it together. So the tabernacle on the inside and the tent around the outside each stood as individual units. So the people from the outside just saw skins. From the inside, beautiful. And he made a covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red, and a covering of porpoise skins above that would have protected it against weather and wind. Then he made the boards for the tabernacle of acacia wood standing upright. 10 cubits was the length of each board, and 1.5 cubits was the width of each board. And there were 2 tenons for each board, fitted to one another. Thus he did for all the boards of the tabernacle. This is basically the frame, the uprights and the crossbeams. And he made the boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side. And he made 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for its 2 tenons. Then for the second side of the tabernacle on the north side, he made 20 boards. And there 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another board. And for the rear of the tabernacle to the west, he made 6 boards. And he made 2 boards for the corners of the tabernacle at the rear. And they were double beneath, and together they were complete to its top, to the first ring. And thus he did with both of them for the 2 corners. And there were 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 under every board. Then he made bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards of one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the tabernacle for the rear side to the west. And he made the middle bar to pass through in the center of the boards from end to end. And he overlaid the boards with gold, and he made their rings of gold as holders for the bar, and overlaid the bars with gold. Yeah, I see Marilyn shaking her head. These are crossbeams and struts on the inside. Why do those need to be gold? Is there any good reason for them to have to be gold? Yeah, just so God could see them. Yeah, just make them as nice as you can make them. Moreover, he made the veil of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, and he made it with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman, and he made 4 pillars of acacia wood for it and overlaid them with gold, with their hooks of gold, and he cast 4 sockets of silver for them, and he made a screen for the doorway of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, the work of a weaver, and he made its 5 pillars with their hooks, and he overlaid their tops and their bands with gold, but their 5 sockets were of bronze. Is this starting to give you some sense of how much gold they brought? And how much material and how much linen they brought? Let me just see if I can read through chapter 37 in a chunk with no comment, because it doesn't really need any comment. This is one of those chapters I warned you about. It's just a tale.
But I have a question.
Sure, of course you do. Why wouldn't you? Oh. Now, Bezalel made the ark of acacia wood. Its length was 2.5 cubits. Its width was 1.5 cubits. And its height, 1.5 cubits. And he overlaid it with pure gold inside and out and made a gold molding for it all around. And he cast 4 rings of gold for it on its 4 feet, even 2 rings on the one side of it and 2 rings on the other side of it. And he made poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold. And he put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry it. And he made a mercy seat of pure gold. He made the mercy seat of pure gold. No wood in that part. Well, that's right. I said I wouldn't comment. And he made a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide. And he made two cherubim of gold. He made them of hammered work at the two ends of the mercy seat, one cherub at the one end and one cherub at the other end. And he made the cherubim of one piece with the mercy seat at the two ends. And the cherubim had their wings spread upward, covering the mercy seat with their wings, with their faces toward each other. The faces of the cherubim were toward the mercy seat. Then he made the table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long and 1 cubit wide and 1.5 cubits high. And he overlaid it with pure gold and made a gold molding for it all around. And he made a rim for it of a hand's breadth all the way around, and made a gold molding for its rim all around. And he cast 4 gold rings in it and put the rings in the 4 corners that were on its 4 feet. Close by the rims were the rings and the holders for the poles to carry the table. And he made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold to carry the table. And he made the utensils which were on the table, its dishes and its pans and its bowls and its jars, with which to pour out libations of pure gold. Then he made the lampstand of pure gold. He made the lampstand of hammered work, its base and its shaft, its cups, its bulbs, and its flowers were of one piece with it. And there were 6 branches going out of its sides, 3 branches of the lampstand from one side of it and 3 branches of the lampstand from the other side of it, 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms, a bulb and a flower in one branch, and 3 cups shaped like almond blossoms, a bulb and a flower in the other branch, so for the 6 branches going out from the lampstand. And in the lampstand there were 4 cups shaped like almond blossoms, its bulbs and its flowers. And the bulb was under the 1st pair of branches coming out of it, and a bulb under the 2nd pair of branches coming out of it, and a bulb under the 3rd pair of branches coming out of it, for the 6 branches coming out of the lampstand. Their bulbs and their branches were of one piece with it, and the whole of it was a single hammered work of pure gold. And he made its 7 lamps, with its snuffers and its trays of pure gold. He made it and all its utensils from 1 talent of pure gold. Then he made the altar of incense of acacia wood, 1 cubit long and 1 cubit wide, square and 2 cubits high. Its horns were of one piece with it, and he overlaid it with pure gold, its top and its sides all around, and its horns. And he made the gold molding for it all around, and he made 2 golden rings for it under its moldings, on its 2 sides, on opposite sides, as holders for poles with which to carry it. And he made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with gold, and he made the holy anointing oil and the pure fragrant incense of spices, the work of a perfumer. Now, I read all that to say, who got to see all that?
God.
And the high priest once a year. And the rest of the time, nobody got to see it. In fact, whenever it was time to fold up the tents and move, the priests would go in and cover all that. And then the reason the poles were there is the poles stuck out each end. And the Levites had to pick up those poles and lift that furniture with the coverings over the furniture. And they never got to see it. All that work, all that gold, all that expense, all that beautiful, glorious golden furniture. When I was, I mentioned a few moments ago that I was in England. Tom, we're starting in chapter 38 in 2 weeks. Okay. I'm counting on you. When I was in England, I went to the Tower of London. Now, I was 13, 1969, when I went there. I was traveling with the Houston All-City Symphony. And we went to England, Scotland, and Wales. We performed at the Royal Academy of Music. And for the weeks that I was over there, I got to see some magnificent things. And you know what impressed me the most that to this day I can still envision in my head? I mean, we're talking 40 years ago, and I can still envision it, is that we went to the Tower of London and we saw the crown jewels. And I got to see some unbelievable jewelry. And the crowns and the stones, the gorgeous, beautiful gold. And just, I mean, wow, no wonder they're called the crown jewels. Unbelievably beautiful. Well, that's what we were just reading about. We were reading about a magnificence and a beauty and a form of sculpture and pure gold. I mean, a Kabbarath with the angels with their wings, all of one gold piece. Magnificent artwork that nobody ever got to see. It was for God's glory. And God said, now make it to my requirements. I'll even pick who's going to make it and name him by name, because I put in him the skill and the ability to make it. And once it's made, it's going to be set aside for my purposes. It's going to have some blood sprinkled on it. And from that point forward, it belongs to God. Nobody else gets to see it. Nobody else gets to use it. And if the high priest comes in and even puts a different kind of incense on that altar that belongs to God, I'll kill him. If anybody but the high priest comes to my tent, I'll kill him. If anybody brings an animal that isn't perfect, spotless, unblemished as a sacrifice, I'll kill him. If anybody argues over the rules I've made and how I say to do it, I'll kill him. I mean, it's all up to God. It's God saying, I'm that holy, I'm that much higher than you, I'm that much separate from you that I can say, this is mine, and you can't touch it. So having established that idea, the whole room is nodding, but the people on the internet can't hear the shaking of your heads as you're nodding. But the whole room is in agreement at this point that God can say, this is mine, you can't touch this anymore. This is mine. Well, that's the same God. That God hasn't changed. And he still has the ability to say, that one's mine, you can't touch it. He can still say, Conrad is mine, you can't touch him. That's holy. I've separated that to myself. I have already blessed that in my son. The blood of my son has consecrated it. In the Old Testament, it took the blood of animals, goats and bulls and sheep would go in and the high priest would go in and sprinkle blood on those things and consecrate them. And once they were consecrated, they belonged to God. And the new covenant says that the blood of Christ has been sprinkled on his church. And now it is consecrated. It belongs to God. You can't touch that. That's mine. God has always been that way. So when you read it in the old covenant and you think, well, that's not very fair. Here's God saying, take all this really precious stuff, and then it's mine, and you can't touch it. And then you get into the new covenant, and it says the people of God are his peculiar people, his set-apart people, consecrated to him, precious in his sight.
We are walking sanctuaries.
Walking sanctuaries, exactly right. You know, that's why we don't have a temple anymore. It's why we don't have a tabernacle in the wilderness anymore. That's Paul's argument, is that the Spirit of God used to come external to Israel, even when the tabernacle was external to the camp. And Moses would go out there and talk to God. But in the new covenant, the sign of the new covenant is the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. And the Spirit of God that used to inhabit the sanctuary or the tabernacle now inhabits his people, and therefore Paul would say, you're the temple of the Holy Spirit. You are now the tabernacle that God indwells. That's such wonderful, wonderful language.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.